part of my practice is somehow embracing serendipity, let's say. Like, I really like to remain open to chance encounters and unexpected moments of inspiration, let's say, no? Like, somehow it's like cultivating awareness, like to be present and mindful on my everyday experiences. And then when you're aware of your surroundings, you notice subtle details, colors, materials that exist in the world just around you.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the Mexican artist José Davia. José is based in Guadalajara, Mexico, where he has his beautiful studio. And José works with sculpture, photography, painting, actually all media. And what that all connects, José is telling us now in the podcast. Welcome, José.
Hello, Johan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. José, what drives my interest always most speaking with my guests is, how did you get in touch with art in your life? Because your parents aren't artists, right?
That's correct. Yes. I mean, it's a peculiar story because my father used to work in a radio station, by the way, and my mother is a psychologist. So actually there were really no connections to art. However, I have two very pivotal experiences that guide me through art. One of them was a complete chance that in the house I used to live with my parents as a kid, exactly in the house in front, across the street, a very famous, very well-known sculptor at the time, Fernando González Gortázar, used to live there. He was my neighbor. I was friends with his daughters. I used to play with them in the street and used to visit their house. And he had a studio at the house. And it was a very, very moving experience for me. Every time I went to the house, I was just mesmerized by the things I saw there. It was a very profound experience. And it was a complete chance. On the other side, on the other hand, I had a really very difficult cancer as a kid. And therefore, I mean, I got cured. I went through chemotherapy and everything. But I had certain restrictions at school of not playing certain sports during, you know, the free hours at school. So I used to go to the art salon in the school, because that was like the nicest place to be in case you could not be like playing football or something. And the teachers there were very nice. I would spend my time there drawing and making like maquettes with plastiline. And I mean, just trying to get my time by. So these two chances actually guide me through art at a very, very early age.
Interesting. But still, you were so somehow impressed or influenced by art, you choose to study architecture instead of art school. Was that because of a lack of art academy?
Yes, actually, I was always very with a big doubt about what to do. I'm not trying to be mean, but the thing is that the art school in Guadalajara was not exactly what I was searching for. I think it was at the time when I visited, it was a little bit like old school, but not in a good way, because old school is good, but
like more academic.
It was more academic, kind of like drawing the nude body and doing like sculptures about, you know, ballet dancers sort of thing. And I went to visit architecture school, and I saw the experiments they were doing with scale, light, with the weight of different materials, with materiality per se in like the laboratorium for materials. And then suddenly I was just more drawn into architecture because of what I saw. However, these things that I realized, these things that caught my attention, actually are things that I apply and I use very much into my sculpture making today.
And did you finish? Like, do you have an? Could you build a house? Are you have a degree in?
Yes. I mean, as I was already like in 2 years into architecture school, I was already starting to do some shows at the age of 21. However, I finished. It was 5 years, and I did my professional degree exam, and I have, you know, I have the professional, you say, like, license in order to, if I wanted to build a house or a building, I actually could. Yes.
So your art practice already started naturally to evolve when you were still even studying architecture.
Yes. I remember my father actually gave me as a birthday present when I turned 18, the complete set of, for making like a photography dark room. Like, in order to develop my own films and be able to print my own photographs. And he also gave me Pentax K1000 camera. I still remember it. And that gift actually was also a catalyzer into me going very much into a more artistic practice, because I was studying architecture, but mostly, like, the rest of my free time, I was taking pictures and developing them in my dark room.
What was your first artwork? Because I think it's often interesting in the practice of artists. Like, you look at Gerhard Richter, you know, his early work, he's not considering part of his oeuvre. So he made these paintings, but they're not part of his catalogue raisonné, because there's a certain sort of crucial time in many artists' career where they say, okay, here I found my language, here I knew what I wanted to express, and this is the work, here the work starts.
Yes, no, I totally agree. No, somehow when you're very, very young as an artist, you are actually exploring and approaching different ideas and concepts from different angles, trying to develop your artistic vision, no? Your artistic language. I think in my case, when I started to feel more confident about finding some footing that I felt it was already coherent with what I'm doing, I think it was actually more by around 2008, 2009, actually. So it's not that long ago, let's say. It's about 14, 15 years. Maybe a little bit earlier. 2007, when I was already doing some artist residencies, and I realized it was a moment where I made peace with myself, in the sense that I understood that sculpture making had a lot to do with the way we understand the world in terms of the relation with the force of gravity, with materiality, that it didn't have to do with architecture as a subject, but rather as very specific strengths that enhance the conceptual practice of sculpture. No? And in that sense, I thought in that moment, I kind of like found that I had a voice there of something to talk about, that it was coherent with certain visual practices in two-dimensional work that I was doing as well.
That's a good point. The two-dimensional works you do, for example, you take images from art history and then you cut elements out, and the image becomes very sculptural because the cutout creates a shadow. And then you often, there are single motifs, like a Picasso, for example, where you cut shapes out, but then there are also other motifs which then you juxtapose together, which create one larger frame, but then there are all these different elements inside. I hope I more or less audibly described the how does this connect to your sculptural work, which play with gravity and force of nature? How did one come about in context to the other?
Yes, I mean, that's a good question, because I have also, I mean, talking about this coherence part, I have to also add, I find very interesting, and it's very appealing to me to work in different mediums, and also allow each medium to express itself in diverse ways, because it's like, let's say, if you were a writer, it's like a writer who can write poetry, but also essay, novel, and maybe even some journalism. At the end of the day, works with a writer works with ideas and with letters, with words. And in that sense, as an artist, for example, I think like each medium has its own inherent qualities and possibilities and evoke different emotional responses to provoke distinct interpretations. So if you navigate through different mediums, you can tap into different strengths and impact with the work more people, no? You push boundaries and explore like new artistic territories. So in that sense, what I'm trying to say is that I do this exploring with different mediums in a very conscious way. I know some artists, which I respect a lot, they work like only in one medium with one very specific, let's say, like message. And I respect that a lot. But I like to explore like in different artistic mediums and working across various mediums to reach a broader spectrum. In the sense specifically about the paper that I cut, I think it has a very long tradition with Mexican cut paper art. It's a very traditional technique of drawing in paper by cutting it. They do it like in the state of Michoacán a lot. It's considered like indigenous art almost in a way. And I think it's what I personally think it connects with sculpture is that it acknowledges that paper is a material that even if it's very thin, it also has three-dimensional qualities. In the moment you cut it and you suspend it and it creates a shadow and it's hung and it has a weight and it has, even paper has different kind of thickness. So it's acknowledging paper as a sculptural material.
Yeah, and I think what's very interesting is that I think in the first ones you did, you cut out buildings, like you have architecture motifs and then the building is sort of cut out. But because you see the volume of the paper and the shadow, it somehow becomes a floating sculpture. And is it right you started with the architecture and then moved into sort of other elements, like on the motifs, I mean?
Yes, that's like, I think at the time when I did the architecture cutouts you are mentioning, I was still trying to find these different motifs that were still very much linked to my past as an architecture student. So I think it just made sense to go directly and cut out these buildings because it was also a reflection upon what is more important in a building. Its surrounding and the experiences it creates, or the building as an object, no? So it was also like posing a question by the fact of deleting the most important image out of the composition. However, with time, I started to develop and realized I could actually take these kind of like reflections and through art history, because as I am self-taught artist, I was consuming a lot of books about other artists and art movements and art history. So then naturally, I then started to use another images that were not actually buildings.
You also physically somehow turned your back on architecture, right? You cut it out somehow.
Yes, exactly. It's somehow kind of, I think maybe that was unconsciously a resignation letter in a way.
And then I really love the works you did, for example, of Dan Flavin, where you took out the Dan Flavin object itself, but the projection, the light which you see reflecting on the wall is still there, but the actual object which creates this light is gone. You also sort of, and very important work of yours, which I remember I was very impressed by, was in Art Basel Miami Beach, where you also cut out. So in maybe it's important to explain, in I think it was also my first participation in Art Basel Miami, there was this container section at the beach where there were overseas shipping containers the fair used to ship walls to the fair. And then they had these empty containers and put walls inside, and then galleries could rent these containers to exhibit art. And it was very difficult exhibition conditions because these small containers had an air condition, but they were very narrow and long, and it was not really the ideal place to exhibit art. And you did a really super great project. You took this shipping container and you cut it apart, and then it was still had the silhouette and the shape of a shipping container, but it, and of course was sort of referencing to Donald Judd, but was a complete sort of intervention on its own. How did you come about it? How were you invited to do a solo project then this you came up with this, or how do you come to this?
Yes, I was invited to do a solo project for this back then, this young gallery in New York City by Leslie Fritz. And actually, I came about exactly what you are talking about. I realized showing art inside a container was really not ideal. It was a really difficult exhibition conditions. So suddenly I thought, you know, I shall then actually work with the reflection that a container is not a good place to show art. So therefore, I'm going to use a container as the art itself. I'm going to intervene it instead of using it to literally contain works, but actually make it the work itself. Basically, that was the main reflection upon that work, and I was at the time very interested in the work of Donald Judd, but in the relationship of Donald Judd sculpture to space and metrics of space and architecture, and I was thinking, what if his very famous boxes were actually changed in scale, and you could experience them physically, anthropomorphically, and therefore it came about this idea of then actually doing the container as if it was, let's say, like a blown up Donald Judd, put in a horizontal condition, and you could walk through it.
So sometimes you appropriate or you work with elements from our daily life, in this case with a container. Another example is the Acapulco chair, which is an interesting chair because it is sort of like a design icon, but it doesn't really have it's like an Eames chair, but it doesn't have an author, no?
Exactly. I mean, that's what actually really struck me with the Acapulco chair is that it might very well be perhaps the most well-known piece of Mexican furniture out there internationally, but it has no author, as you very well mentioned, and it has no patent. You can freely make an Acapulco chair that it's always about your interpretation of it. There's no an exact plan, or there's not an exact execution drawings. And that's also very interesting because I think there we find a very democratic common language of speaking about the same thing, but with very subtle like differences. No?
And how do you build them from scratch, or you take existing ones and rework them? How tell us a bit how you also work in your studio.
In my studio, I try to use and control as much as possible of every single procedure that goes into the work. However, there is a couple of things that I always go with outside, let's say, contractors. One of them actually is the painting in sculpture for like metal objects. I've been working with this atelier that paints cars, you know, and cars when they go into a wreckage and they have to fix them. But I've been working with this like car painter over more than 10 years now. So he knows very well what I want to do. And he has a exquisite technique for painting metal. And he has everything you need to do so in a scale and size that if I were to do so in my studio, it would be very difficult, no? However, I also started working with a metal welder outside of my studio, also about 10 years ago. And he was building Acapulco chairs to sell them, but I think he didn't have very much good luck in selling them. so then suddenly,
but very competitive, no? Because if there's no patent, then
exactly. I mean, if you're just like a metal welder and you don't have like a fancy furniture shop, it's actually not a very good place to like sell Acapulco chairs. So he made a lot, I think, thinking he was going to sell them like crazy. He didn't sell one. And he had them like in a corner, just like one on top of each other, just like a mountain of Acapulco chairs. And when I saw that, I could not restrain myself for suddenly seeing this object trouvé, no, very Duchampian object. No, I saw it and I thought, like, okay, this is an artwork already here. Even reminded me of the bottle rack of Marcel Duchamp. So then this guy is called Ramon, and I told Ramon, look, I would really like to buy, you know, a good bunch of these Acapulco chairs you have there. No? So he told me, oh, that's great, because I didn't sell one, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, ah, perfect. And then he kind of like started like grabbing them. And I said, like, no, but you have to leave them exactly as they are. I need you to put some welding points so they stay like that. And then he started laughing, because it's always like, okay, what do you want them for? I said, well, I'm going to do a sculpture with them. So I took them and I had them in my studio, which is another thing about my studio. I tend to collect a lot of things, objects I found in the street, the stones I get from the mountains, or I buy in different places. I mean, a lot of things I gather, because at the end of the day, later on, they actually build my artistic language, which I work sculpture with. But when I grab these materials, I don't have exactly an idea what I'm going to use them for. I just know I like them as materials, and I start stacking them. So I have problems of storage, because I just keep a lot of shit inside my studio, because I know at some point I'm going to use them at some point. So, for example, these Acapulco chairs, I brought them to my studio, but I wasn't really aware exactly what I was going to do with them. And I think they sat in my studio for maybe 5-6 years, until suddenly one day I got it and I knew how I wanted the Acapulco chairs to have a dialogue with different stones and create a dialogue between the fragile and the solid and the geometric shapes of the Acapulco chair upon the very natural shapes of stones, etc. But it took me a few years. And now I buy Acapulco chairs from him. So at the end of the day, he actually was able to do a good business with Acapulco chairs, but through me.
How important is sort of the Mexican DNA of the Acapulco chair?
I think I use it a little bit in a sarcastic way about the nationality of objects and their symbolism, no? But also it's interesting how, yes, even objects have a national identity, a passport, let's say, no? So therefore, suddenly, when some people ask me, like, well, you know, is your sculpture, is your work really like Mexican or international? And I find with like that question, I always say, well, I really don't know, because if my sculpture is Mexican, it's an organic result that I am Mexican. I live in Mexico. I eat Mexican food. I sleep in Mexico. But I'm not trying per se to do like a Mexican work, quotes. However, then using a Mexican piece of furniture just adds up to this like conversation and reflection upon what is the nationality on the nature of the work, no?
Yeah, but it also, hearing how you came about it, it's just also a reaction how you walk through life and are influenced by your surrounding and what sort of inspires you and how one thing comes to the other. A significant element in your work, and also was our first exhibition we did together a couple of years ago. The title was The Stone, The Builder Refused, was a spectacular piece of three giant marble plates, which were the work is titled Joint Effort, and is so it's three very large white marble plates, and they are leaning among each other, so they are connected with sort of tape, which is often seen on when goods are shipped around on trucks, or you have a pallet of books or stones. But here you had these three giant, they were 2 by 3 meter or even bigger each, and they were all leaning in the belts. But if one would be out of line, they all would collapse. I hope I more or less described it well. And this, the strap band you're using, that's often appearing in your work. How did this, when did you start to use this? Because it's a very, I mean, in all the sculpture and painting, all what has been done, it's so difficult to bring some new innovative elements, which also somehow represent something into the practice. How did you come about this?
Yes, actually, it's funny, Johan, because these, I think they're called in English, ratchet straps. Yes, and as the public should know and everyone knows, they are normally used in shipping trucks, no, for securing heavy elements for not moving, or you know, they have, you know. So the funny thing is, they came into my studio organically, naturally, because I was bringing heavy rocks into my studio on top of wooden pallets, but then the rocks needed to be strained to the pallet with these ratchet straps in order to move them with a weight lift car, no?
Yeah.
So they don't fall off. And suddenly these ratchet straps were all over my studio for some time with these stones and heavy material. And at some point I realized, like, well, they are already here. They are already having a very interesting dialogue with the stone and creating like a support and like a joint effort for making the rock not fall, and against like the gravity, because the rock wants to fall and the strap is actually providing doesn't falling. So then suddenly it was just a natural way to say, well, they are a part of the work. I'm going to incorporate them in the sculpture and not just leaving them outside of the sculpture.
Interesting. So you, again, just open-eyed, you noticed it. Because what I like so much about them is that they have these bright colors, and you use them in outdoor works. And a very big problem in outdoor works is color, because the sun is just bleaching out everything. And these straps bring somehow a little pop and a little sort of commercial critique, or, you know, you have all these association to these straps, and they bring a fresh element into the work. So you found it more as a coincidence, and then you started to include them in your practice.
Yes, I think part of my practice is somehow embracing serendipity, let's say. Like, I really like to remain open to chance encounters and unexpected moments of inspiration, let's say, no? Like, somehow it's like cultivating awareness, like to be present and mindful on my everyday experiences. And then when you're aware of your surroundings, you notice subtle details, colors, materials that exist in the world just around you. So I think part of my visual vocabulary, somehow, let's say, or my own artistic voice, is actually being always able to keep my eyes open and embrace this chance, and allow myself to actually incorporate the work. And in that sense, takes the work into a more everyday sort of object that escapes the academic canons of art in that sense. So.
And tell me, you explained me once before, I was very impressed. I try to get it together again. So, because what I interesting find on sculpture, usually it's either you take away or you add. Right, you have like a solid stone, and then you like the Bildhauer, the classic Michelangelo, they hit parts away, and then the sculpture sort of comes out. Or you take a clay and add and build something out of it. And the stones you use and in your work, somehow there's a line related to the earth of stones which come out of the ground, or which have been sort of washed over and over on the sea, so they become these like soft shape.
I mean, I use different kinds of stones also for different like symbolic reasons. Now, some stones are the result of compression and being pushed by these incredible forces that make this compression. But then there are also stones that actually are formed by heat, no, by let's say by inner earth fire somehow,
and like and volcano stones,
exactly. And their composition, it's actually like very different. And I like to be aware of that situation in order to symbolically use them for different aspects. However, I like to think very much that sculpture exists because of how its elements like come together, no? Understanding that as an exploration of composition, relationships, and the transformative power of arrangement. Let's say if you have like two different rocks and a piece of wood and a block of concrete, and somehow you put them together in a way that actually then it makes a sculpture. That's why I like to title some sculptures joint effort, because they are together doing something. But then if you dissemble the sculpture, the rock is just a rock, and you put them back in nature, the rock is not transformed in any way. So then it's just a rock back in nature, and a piece of glass is just a piece of glass that you put back in a window, and it's just glass. However, in the way they are together, they become a sculpture. Understanding a sculpture as an event, let's say, no?
Mm-hmm. Like almost like a collage of ready-mades or collage of objets trouvés.
Exactly, no? Like the relationships between these elements is actually what makes them become a sculpture, as long as they are working together. Because if you dismantle them and put them back to where they are, then suddenly it's just a metal beam, it's just a piece of glass, and it's just a rock. They haven't been transformed in any way. So it's almost like when they dance together, then they are a sculpture, they are art.
Mm-hmm. And so the conscious spectator, then sometimes you do interventions, like you paint a stone blue, or you include an apple. Then there are sort of references to history and art history?
Yes, definitely. Somehow, I think like basically like using references from other works of art, it's a way to pay homage to artists who have influenced me or whose work I admire. But they also serve as a form of intertextuality, no? Because you build upon existing cultural references and you invite viewers to make connections between different artistic traditions and periods. So then I'm inviting the public and the viewers to make these connections and actually make the artwork a place to start thinking about art and making their own reflections. So then you create content by what you remember of the work, not only by the object you are looking at.
But then the apple obviously refers to Newton, no?
Yes, I mean, it has a very direct reflect to Newton, but it also, I mean, I was very interested in the apple because then I started to fall into the, let's say, discovery that it has thousands of references. It's a fruit that is the reference fruit, no? I mean, it also has the reference to Adam and Eve and how like the apple made us lose our sense of like innocence. But then it also had the reference to William Tell and the idea of like human deep emotions about like control and power. But it was then also used by the Beatles for their record label. But it was also used by Turing to put like poison and kill himself, later on then used by Steve Jobs, for example. But it was obviously used in the very famous Walt Disney movie of Blancanieves, that the witch gives her like an apple to actually, you know, poison her. And then you just continue, and then you realize the apple, for some reason, is everywhere in different cultures, from pop to history, in different places. And obviously, I think Isaac Newton, regardless of obviously how important as a scientific was, he was very much a very good divulgator, communicator. I sometimes tend to think that the story about the apple falling in his head, it was actually a made-up one in order to be able to explain a concept that no one would have understood in scientific terms. But then with this story about an apple falling into his head, he was able to explain somehow very abstract concept at the time, no?
Narratives work. But then I sort of clearly identify Eve Klein with a blue stone, but probably there's more to it, no?
Yes, well, I mean, actually, the blue stone is directly Eve Klein, but it's also a color somehow that was very much used in a way by Luis Barragán, the architect. And it was also the color that Frida Kahlo house had in Mexico City. And I mean, there's a few references to that in art, no?
Yeah, and maybe also the opposite of, like, you have the blue sky above the rocks on the ground or something, no? Or the earth.
Yes, I mean, what I also like about these, like, references, not exactly like appropriation, but these suggestions, is that they actually appeal to public of, they can make interpretations and reinterpretations that are very fluid and open to multiple perspectives. Depending on who is seeing that, it actually gives like different perspectives. So then the idea of originality or authorship or the very basic fact of ownership of ideas comes then into question by making all these references and letting people make their own assumptions.
Yeah, reminds me a bit of the work you did in Los Angeles, where you had a group of concrete blocks, which have all different geometric forms, which were spread all over the city and used as a bench to sit down, or people were skateboarding on it, graffitiing on it. And then you, after a certain time, you collected them all again and put them together, almost like a Rubik's Cube. All these concrete elements came together and they all had different marks from where they were sort of used before. How different were the different elements from, because we're all over the city, no?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's a very good description you made, that it was a little bit also like kind of like a Tetris game, three-dimensional Tetris cube. And it got dismantled. All these different, like 40 different parts were put in very different places in LA. From the ocean to the mountains, from the city center to Beverly Hills, to like they were all over around, and they stayed over a year in their different like places, and maybe like all of them actually, except the one in front of the police station in Beverly Hills, all the other ones got actually like graffiti or even very precise like frescoes, let's say, you know, like from street painters. There were not only like graffiti, they were properly like paintings, for example. So the this sculpture became like a device, as a sponge, let's say, that soaked upon urban life of LA and urban art in LA. And then when we put it back together, it was, I guess, a little bit like these Russian Matryoshka dolls. The ones that always have like a smaller doll inside, and then you open and there's another smaller doll, and you keep going and going. So then this like cube, it had all this sort of like graffiti and painting outside, but if you start like opening the pieces again, you actually start discovering other kind of other different paintings and graffiti that were done. So at the end of the day, it was a device that is like a three-dimensional street mural done by, how you say, by artists or people that you will never know who they were. No, it's absent, the absence of authorship.
But interesting that the one from the police station remained completely untouched, so it was permanently protected.
Yes, and also, you know, Tony, that we were very careful about trying to photograph the life of these sculptures in the different places, how people use them. No, like, some people were like taking naps on top of them. Some kids were obviously playing on top of them. Some people were, I don't know, in the Santa Monica Pier, were using it to step on top and making selfies, et cetera, et cetera. But the one in Beverly Hills, no one really used it ever. No, I mean, I realized no one really walked past through it. It was really deserted in all senses. No one used it and no one graffitied it.
And they all had different shapes, right?
Yes, they all had different shapes, kind of like the Tetris game. I think it was also interesting to realize, but I came upon that reflection at the end of the project. It was not an intention I have, but it made me think about it. How, as a person, as an immigrant, as a traveler, when you make a journey, like a 1-year journey, let's say, and you come back, you're never the same person that left your house a year ago. And I think that happened to this project as a sculpture. When it started, it was something. And after 1 year, when it came back to its original place, it was a very different object than the one I did. So it took like a life of its own.
Sure, and it get marks and scarves and things like this, right? Yeah, and traces. Exactly. Yeah. And when you did this project at Rockefeller Center in New York, do you react to the architecture around it? So there you had a big concrete block, put a stone in the middle and another concrete block on top and put this strap around. Do you react then to the skyscrapers around? Or
Yes. I was reacting. I wanted to react more precisely towards the idea of verticality in Manhattan, not specifically to the architecture in terms of style, but to the idea of verticality, which sounds very simple, but in a way is what actually defines, and it's shared by maybe every single building in Manhattan. Somehow it has a verticality issue, let's say, situation. So I wanted the sculpture to attend that issue per se and be like about verticality in that sense.
And maybe last, tell us what you're working on right now. We are opening a show in Seoul in Korea now with new paintings. Maybe you tell us about these paintings also.
Let's say I'm very happy working with painting because that's what I used to do almost every day as a kid. Going back also to the very like first question you post in the podcast. I used to paint every single day. I know a lot of kids do, but it was on a very serious way I used to paint. So I guess also somehow when I became a professional artist, I was a bit reluctant of painting because it had the reference to me as what I did as a kid. So it took me a lot of years to come to terms personally with my own idea of what it meant to paint. It wasn't easy for me to accept it and go back to that medium. However, it's something I obviously really enjoy and love. And therefore, these paintings, they all have in common something as simple as the circle, as a shape that it has been used so many times by so many different artists in the 20th century, but also in history of painting. No, there is thousands of references. Let's say painting a circle is like painting a landscape or painting the sea. Everyone has done it, but everyone does it in their own style, concept, and idea. Also, I mean, somehow like as the Acapulco chair in that sense. No? So I understood there was a lot of references that could actually perhaps somehow be perceived negatively. But at the same time, if you just scrap a little bit below the surface, you realize the circle is there in so many references by so many artists that it's interesting to do it like once more and to do your own version. So all these paintings revolve around a research I did in the time of the pandemic about the circle and the very important circles in the 20th century, no? And then incorporate them kind of in a copy paste sort of way, like taking these circles that I was interested with and use them to compose like new and personal meaning. No, you can find like circles from Kandinsky, Malevich, Ellsworth Kelly, Bridget Riley, Frank Stella, Kilmuth Clint, and the list goes on, and Walter Drexel, and different like. I mean, the list just goes on, but like, so it's like doing this like level field of painting with circles to make my own work, no? And this is very much what the paintings for the show in Seoul are about.
But it's interesting that you mentioned this because somehow, maybe because of the colored view, I would have thought also that they have somehow a Mexican vocabulary, a visual vocabulary, but after all, maybe it's just more modernistic, no?
Yes, I mean, I mean the modern movement, it also has like a very strong stroke in Mexico, no? Like I think in the 30s and 40s, even 50s, you know, the modern movement in Mexico was really very present. And I think you're very right, Johan. I hadn't thought about that in that sense. But I think they strike a chord about the Mexican understanding of modernism, I think.
Which is interesting when you mentioned Barragán, for example. I'm such a huge fan of Barragán since many years. And wanted to, when we were renovating the church, I was thinking of if we could pick up his sort of color scheme, but you can't replace that. It's working in Mexico and it works in Los Angeles, but you can't do that in a northern country because the light is just not, I don't know, maybe 1 week a year, you have like the same intensity, you know.
1 week in July.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you, Jose. I think we got a good idea. What are you working on besides the show in Seoul right now?
I'm also working on an exhibition in Saudi Arabia of outdoor sculpture that has to do with electric light, let's say, curated by Jerome Sanz and Pedro.
Mm-hmm. Pedro Alonso, great curator.
Pedro Alonso and Jerome Sanz are curating this. I think it's a big project. I mean, it's not like a biennial, but it has this big project situation. It's going to happen in November, so I'm working into that because it's almost kind of like a landscape intervention, but it has to include somehow, however way you want it, electric light. So that's a challenge into outdoor sculpture in a way, no?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Great. You can't tell more yet, I guess.
No, sorry. I cannot tell more than that. Basically.
Perfect. We keep following. Thank you so much, Jose, and very much looking forward to the project in Seoul.
Thank you. Thank you much. Thank you very much, Johan. It's always a pleasure then talking about work and talking with you here.
Thanks.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.